This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the nation's most prominent independent socialist fights for re-election against a mountain of corporate money in Seattle. Mumia Abu-Jamal says the Confederate flag may have lost its luster, but the Civil War still ain't over. And Dr. Gerald Horn explains why slavery is inseparable from the saga of the United States. But first, the Black metropolis of Detroit lies smack in the middle of one of the major freshwater regions of the world. However, the city's water pressure is so low that a recent major fire was difficult to bring under control. We spoke with Abiyomi Azikwe, a longtime Detroit activist and editor of the Pan-African Newswire.
This is not a surprising development. This has been happening in residential areas throughout the city, for example, in the Boston Edison District, which is designated as a historical district by the United States, was the victim during the winter when a family had refurbished a home in this historic district and a fire broke out in the basement. The fire company came promptly, yet the fire hydrants did not have enough pressure, and therefore the fire department as well as the family had to stand there and watch the home burn to the ground after they had invested $50,000 to $60,000 in the home. And this is, of course, is being advertised and promoted by the powers that be, including the city administration and others, as an area that's designated for people to repopulate. So it's not surprising that these developments are taking place. The whole process of the so-called rebuilding of Detroit has not been clearly thought out. I mean, how can you rebuild a city when you don't have fundamental infrastructure, such as fire services, such as public safety, education, emergency medical services, simple things such as being able to go to a supermarket, being able to go and purchase basic commodities that people need as essential services? That coupled with the crisis in the water, where the shutoffs are still taking place, some 1 year after Detroit was exposed during the bankruptcy as being grossly negligent in regard to providing water resources to its hundreds of thousands of residents, as well as the situation involving the massive eviction that is going to take place later on this year because the county treasurer and the governor of the state refused to impose an indefinite moratorium on property tax foreclosures. So this whole process of repopulation is contradictory, and it is a process that is gravely flawed.
It sounds like a place that the powers that be don't really want repopulated, at least not with the kind of population that Detroit now has.
No, it does not. And they're doing everything in their power to drive out the African population of Detroit through, first of all, job losses through capital flight. On top of that, you have the whole process of predatory lending, which wiped out at least a quarter of a million people over the last decade and a half. And then now, with the overinflated property tax assessments, which people are in no position to pay because there is a lack of jobs, there's a lack of solid and livable wages and income, and then the lack of services, the lack of educational infrastructure, anyone who has children who wants to educate them, Detroit is not a place that would attract such a population. So you see a lot of people, a lot of African-American working-class people moving to suburban areas such as Rosedale, Warren, Lathrop Village, Southfield, and so forth, even Novi and Wixom, because of the lack of services in the city. And I think it's a concerted campaign to deconcentrate for political purposes the African-American community in the city of Detroit, which historically has been a source of nationalist politics, left politics, labor agitation, and organizing.
And one might suspect that once the population reaches the kind of makeup that the powers that be would prefer the spigots will turn back on and services will be delivered once more.
Well, this is the theory that they're operating out of the Detroit future cities, but that even remains to be seen because even for whites who are from middle class, upper middle class, and wealthy backgrounds, the whole issue of education, food services, public transportation, street criminal activity, which has skyrocketed in the last several months, remains an impediment for the repopulation of the city, even by those that they're attempting to attract, meaning the upper middle class European American demographic in the United States, and perhaps some African Americans who can afford to pay anywhere between $1,200 and $2,200 a month in rent. These are the people that they want to attract to the city. But the question is, do they have the infrastructure in place to actually attract these people and get them to stay? People who have moved into the city at the aegis of the banks and the corporations have also moved out rather rapidly because of the lack of these basic infrastructures. So what we have is the anarchy of capitalism, where even though there may be some rhetorical initiatives in regard to repopulation and refurbishing and revitalization, the fact of the matter is, even the capitalist system itself in the United States right now is not in a position to provide the capital, to provide the planning and the incentives to truly revitalize and repopulate the cities, basically in their own image.
So they can't even get gentrification and ethnic cleansing right?
No. I mean, it's like what we've seen in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, in Libya, in Sudan. We've seen imperialism intervening, you know, in these countries, engaging in regime change, anti-terrorism campaigns, and so forth. Yet, all we have is chaos, destabilization, disorganization, which provides a rationale at the same time for the Pentagon, the CIA, the National Security Agency to remain engaged in these geopolitical areas. It's the same scenario on a domestic level, where you deny people jobs, you deny people economic opportunities, you increase political repression through undemocratic laws, undemocratic methods of governance, police terrorism and repression, and at the same time, the overall idea of fostering democracy and economic development remains unfulfilled.
People in Detroit must be looking at the situation in Greece with a very special kind of perspective, Greece being under siege by the same financial forces that have laid waste to Detroit.
What's really interesting about Greece, and what's interesting about Puerto Rico as well, is that it mirrors what has taken place here in the city of Detroit. The attacks on pensions, the designation and the claim that the people there owe billions upon billions of dollars to the banks and the bond rating agencies, in fact, rubber stamping those claims. So this is the struggle of modern capitalism. I don't think it's strictly isolated to Greece or to Puerto Rico. It's a process that is taking place internationally. And I think it represents the decline of the current economic system, world economic system. And until people are organized, until they're mobilized, until they have the vision for a new system, this is going to continue. If you look at Greece, they went after the pension. They've been attacking the whole notion of a social contract or a social network. We see the same situation in Puerto Rico. They have to change the law in order to provide a pseudo-legal rationale for them to be put into bankruptcy, as they did in the city of Detroit. They even brought Stephen Rhodes. They brought him to Puerto Rico as a consultant. Now, he was the federal judge that oversaw the Detroit bankruptcy and restructuring. So it's the same process that's going on. And for people who think that they're lucky that they don't live in Detroit, that they don't live in Greece, that they don't live in Puerto Rico, this is coming to their city as well.
That was Abayomi Azikwe speaking from Detroit. Socialist Alternative Party Councilwoman Kashama Sawant is running for re-election in Seattle, Washington, where the rich and powerful have poured money into the campaign coffers of her major rival, Pamela Banks, the CEO of the local Urban League.
Sawant succeeded in passing the city's $15 an hour minimum wage bill and is the nation's most prominent socialist, unless you count Democratic Party presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. She says that's why corporations are funding her opponent.
Absolutely. And the donors that have already filled the coffers of our opponent, I mean, it's quite instructive to look at who they are. One of the donors is Dawn Stark, who was the principal lobbyist against the labor movement's $15 an hour campaign in SeaTac, the small city that achieved 15 the year before Seattle won $15 an hour, and which was really the springboard for Seattle's 15. Our opponent has also received donations from executives from Alaska Airlines, which also is a corporation based in SeaTac, because that's where the international airport is located. And Alaska Airlines is one of the major corporate bullies, which is refusing to comply with the voters' mandate on $15 an hour. And in fact, last year, in last November, myself and representative of the faith community and two workers were arrested in a nonviolent civil disobedience action to call attention to Alaska Airlines' refusal to comply with the voter mandate on 15. The corporate donors of our opponent also include executives from Starbucks, Amazon.com, and a corporation called Vulcan, which is a real estate giant initiated by the billionaire Paul Allen. And that is just a glimpse into how systematically the corporations are zeroing in to donate to our opponent's campaign. And it's even companies like timber companies, for example, which, you know, the first question I had was, why are timber companies donating to a race in a district in Seattle? And the answer to this question, and the answer to why all these corporations are flooding the campaign coffers of our opponent, is this. It's not so much about that opponent's qualities, but it's because corporations, billionaires, you know, the people who have every interest and incentive in upholding the status quo, have the recognition that if we, socialist alternative, Shama Sawant, if the agenda of working people wins re-election this year, then it really confirms to working people in Seattle and everywhere that this can be done. We can have a principled position. We can be faced with the full might of big business and the political establishment, and yet we can prevail. That's a powerful message to send to an American working class that has been so pushed down for decades, and the labor movement that has had so many defeats in the last several decades, and this is going to be an empowering message for a new generation. And the corporate representatives correctly recognize that this is a threat for the status quo.
So they fear the threat of a good example.
Yes, I could not put it better. It's the threat of a good example.
Has Comcast donated any money to your opponent? You've been agitating for the city of Seattle to operate its own internet service and not depend upon the duopoly of Comcast and CenturyLink for those services.
Right. I don't know if Comcast and CenturyLink have donated, but I would say this. A lot of politicians, some of whom are running for re-election this year in Seattle, including the mayor of Seattle, current mayor of Seattle, who is not running for re-election this year, but has been a long-time politician in the state of Washington, many of them have received donations from Comcast and CenturyLink over the years for their campaigns. And so it was no surprise to us that even though the study that was done on municipal broadband showed that actually we might have an optimistic outlook for establishing municipal broadband, you know, even though we had that outlook from the study, the mayor's office responded to that study by saying, oh, this is really pessimistic, this can't be done, all right, case closed, and completely abdicated that role that they should be playing, which is to address the fact that Comcast, you know, engages in price gouging and provides substandard, unreliable service to the majority of customers in Seattle, not to mention the digital divide. 20% of Seattle has little or no access to the internet. It is actually very linked with what opportunities low-income and poor people and immigrants and people of color have. Every time you want to fill out a job application, you depend on the internet today. So the majority of people are in agreement in Seattle that internet access, high-speed, reliable internet access is not a luxury in today's world. It is a necessity. And so as the study itself found, 65% of the people surveyed, people in Seattle surveyed, said in a random sample, said that they think the city should be building its own broadband network. So that's why we picked up the ball and said, I think this is absolutely necessary. We need to be doing this. But we've also correctly pointed out every step of the way that don't expect corporate politicians who take donations from Comcast and CenturyLink to stand with us and fight with us. If we want municipal broadband, it is no different than $15 an hour in the sense that we will have to build a mass momentum to push for it.
The mayor and his people say, well, Comcast might cut its rates and thereby harm a publicly owned facility. Is he afraid of Comcast or beholden to Comcast?
I think it is more accurate to say that these politicians are beholden to Comcast. And in fact, if we look at the example of other cities that have succeeded in establishing municipal broadband, I think we can look at Chattanooga, for example, which is considered the gold standard of municipal broadband at this moment because it's highly successful. It's been around for a few years. But if you look back at the history of recent history of Chattanooga, when the city first started the momentum around municipal broadband, Comcast went to war against the city. Comcast launched 2,600 attack ads against the idea of municipal broadband and fought four lawsuits against the city to prevent that from doing. But they didn't succeed. Comcast didn't succeed in preventing municipal broadband from being successful in Chattanooga. But the only reason they weren't is because the city stood strong against that kind of bullying. And the point we're making in Seattle is that this is not going to happen. Municipal broadband is not going to happen because it's an absolutely fantastic and rational idea, which it is. But it will come, in, it will see the light of day only if we recognize that we have to fight back against corporate interests.
Seattle has a reputation as being a rather liberal city on, in American terms, and yet it can't do what a city, a medium-sized city in eastern Tennessee can do in terms of internet?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question about whether or not Seattle is progressive. I mean, I think the reality is this. If when we say Seattle, if we mean ordinary working people in Seattle, absolutely no question that the vast majority of the people in this city are truly liberal, truly progressive, truly social justice minded. There is no question about that. The point, though, is that that progressive thinking, that social justice minded thinking is not reflected in the political establishment of this city. The political establishment of this city is no different, fundamentally is no different than in Chicago or in New York City in the sense that it is a one-party city. It's been dominated by the Democratic Party establishment. But in reality, a lot of the problems that exist in Seattle fall at the doorstep of the Democratic Party because there are no Republicans for them to blame here. So if there is increasing gap between the rich and poor, if there is massive displacement of working people and people of color from the city core because housing is so unaffordable, if there is pervasive and systematic racial disparities in Seattle public schools, all of this lies at the doorstep of the establishment of the Democratic Party, which has been ruling this city for decades. And so the gap is not between what should be progressive and what people think in Seattle, but the gap is between the progressive thinking of the majority of people in this city and the corporate politicians that win elections year after year. And that's the kind of thing that has been put into question because of my election in 2013. You know, with me in City Hall, they no longer are comfortably able to convince the people in Seattle, oh, whatever crumbs we are willing to give you, that's the best we can do for you. And you know, you should be happy. This is a progressive city. We're progressive. You know, all city council members are progressive. This is great. They're no longer able to simply pay lip service to these issues and dole out crumbs anymore because our voice is right here in City Hall to call that into question, which is why trying to unseat us is their number one goal this year.
And how does a socialist pay for a campaign that's opposed by an array of forces like that?
That grassroots campaign that is truly committed to the interests of working people and is trying to point the way forward in fighting corporate politics that the majority of Americans are disgusted by, that campaign relies on donations by working people. And indeed, it is not just about donations. It's about building the strength from below so that people do not think of this campaign as, oh, this is a great thing, I'll be happy if Sharma is reelected in November. No, this is a campaign that hundreds of people feel deeply invested in because they recognize that this is not about this candidate named Sharma Sawant. It is about what we are trying to fight for. It is about upholding the energy and the morale of the movement that we've succeeded in building so far, but understanding that it has a long way to go. And that's why this re-election is a major milestone in determining the future course of that very movement. And a large number of workers also recognize how this can be contagious. When we won 15 in Seattle, it didn't remain limited to Seattle. San Francisco won it. Los Angeles won it. Other cities will be poised very soon to win it, like Minneapolis, Chicago, and New York City. Workers recognize that this is a great thing, and in order to keep moving forward and not backsliding into the status quo of inequality, we need to win this re-election campaign. So this campaign relies and works alongside all those working people. Just to give you concrete examples, we now have the largest number of donors of any race, of any candidate in all the city council races. This year, we have the lowest average donation of any campaign in this city. In fact, I think yesterday we recorded 1,500 donors. I'm sure it's more than that now because it's 24 hours since I looked at it. 1,500 donors, that's a big number.
Now, of course, if you're not successful, the corporate media will proclaim that socialism has been repudiated.
Yes, there is a lot at stake for our re-election. It will be seized upon by the corporate media, by the establishments, not just in Seattle, but nationally. Nationally, the political establishment is watching. It will give an opportunity for the establishment to be able to declare that, well, that was great. There was a flash in the pan. Now let's go back to the politics of the grown-ups, by which they mean, you know, corporate politics, politics of the status quo. So we are at every step of the way reminding people who are with us that we have no room to be complacent. We have no room to think, well, we have the mandate of the majority now. We can rest on our laurels. We are pointing out every step of the way that we have to recognize what's at stake, fight for it, and keep our eye on the prize. You know, our prize is not only winning the election on November 3rd, but also the potential for building the U.S. left that is presented on the basis of winning that victory in Seattle.
Kashama Sawant of the Socialist Alternative Party in Seattle. The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, remains stricken with an undiagnosed illness at a Pennsylvania prison. Despite his health problems, Abu-Jamal continues to file reports with Prison Radio. This one is titled, Flags and Rags.
The current controversy over the Confederate battle flag fluttering over the Capitol building in Columbia, South Carolina, is a testament to many things, the least of which is whether it is a symbol of racism. It is a measure of how backward and repressive some areas of the country are, caught in the fractured memory of the past, a past that was, for millions, far more horrific than it was glorious. Anyone who studies American history learns that South Carolina constantly threatened to secede from the Union. Indeed, in the classic work of French political scientist Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, written several generations before the firing on Fort Sumter, South Carolina threatens to split from the Union. That contrariness, that sense of false, bruised pride, that deep paranoia bred in the bone because of the knowledge of centuries of crimes and cruelties waged against Africans lies in the heart of the state like a stone. Of all the slave-built colonies of the South, none exceeded South Carolina for its huge, teeming black population, which lived in constant terror. That is the heritage of the Confederate battle flag, one of terror and violence in support of a system of organized theft of black labor in the name of white supremacy and black subjugation. Dylan Dumb and Dumber Roof knew instinctively what the flag stood for, as well as the flags of apartheid South Africa and the former Rhodesia. He knew what he was wearing and waving. History has consigned the apartheid flags and Rhodesia's banners to the annals of a history that is past. But in parts of the United States, it flaps in the breeze as if it is still 1860, a symbol of a war against freedom. For far too many people, the war, the Civil War, still ain't over.
That was political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. Prison activist and writer Kenneth A. Hartman is serving a life sentence at the California State Prison in Lancaster, in Los Angeles County. He says prisoners remain less than human in the eyes of the nation's highest court.
The U.S. Supreme Court ended its term with a couple of wins for progressive voices, upholding the Affordable Care Act and, finally, granting marriage equality to all Americans. But the conservative majority managed to regroup on the issue of the death penalty, allowing the states to go ahead and conduct lethal injection executions with a patched-together three-drug cocktail that doesn't always work. Justice Sotomayor, in her dissent, likened the result to being burned at the stake, dying in a state of being burned alive, but from the inside. After the high-minded rhetoric of the health care and marriage equality decisions, the thuggish tone of the majority in the death penalty case sounded especially ugly, and it laid bare a fundamental truth of criminal justice jurisprudence in this country. Prisoners remain less than human. This has to be so, because how else can a decision that allows for deliberate torture be explained? As bad as that death penalty decision is, it's certainly not the only evidence that we prisoners are not accorded our humanity. Far from it. The U.S. Supreme Court has long ruled that prisoners don't deserve to be treated as full humans. It's legal to deny us the vote. It's legal to compel us to wear humiliating uniforms. It's legal to force us to live in conditions that ought to shock the conscience of a normal person. It's legal to deny us a whole panoply of rights and privileges solely because we're in prison, even when the exercise of those rights and privileges would not impact the prison in any meaningful way. It's worth noting that our peer nations do not treat their prisoners in a similar fashion. Most all democracies allow prisoners to vote. France recently passed a law forbidding any prisoner from wearing clothing that identified them as prisoners. Orange is most definitely not the new black there. More fundamentally, our peer nations don't strap prisoners down onto a gurney and inject poison into their veins so they can burn to death from the inside. They also don't sentence prisoners to life without the possibility of parole, the other death penalty, so they can gradually disappear into a fog of misery. Because doing either of those barbaric acts to another human being would be wrong, period. Until everyone in this country is accorded their full human rights, including prisoners, the fight must continue. It's not yet time to declare victory.
Prison activist Kenneth A. Hartman, reporting for Prison Radio. Dr. Gerald Horn, Chairman of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, is one of America's most prolific public intellectuals, the author of more than 30 books. In one of his latest works, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Dr. Horn maintains that the United States is not only a society born in genocide and slavery, but that the white settlers fought a war of independence against Great Britain in order to keep the right to hold black people in chains. Dr. Horn gave a lecture earlier this year at the Center for Black Studies Research at the University of California at Santa Barbara. The United States, he said, was shaped by the business of slavery and deep-set fears of black people.
This African slave trade, as previous scholars have discussed, was in many ways the fuel that provided the takeoff for capitalism. This is a conclusion that has been delivered, for example, by the former Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago, the scholar Eric Williams, a conclusion delivered by the Guyanese scholar Walter Rodney in his book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And you should know, for our purposes here, that the profits from the African slave trade not only helped to produce sugar and tobacco, amongst other crops in profusion, helping to, for example, change the taste and appetites, particularly in Western Europe, but the profits from the African slave trade were also used to develop allied industries, banking, insurance, shipping, etc., helping to create the foundation of not only for the system that we now refer to as capitalism, but also for the economy of what is now the leading so-called superpower, that is to say, the United States of America. But the African slave trade, as noted, was a catastrophic success. The catastrophe not only comes in with regard to the lives and families of the Africans that are disrupted and seized and snatched, but in some ways it becomes a catastrophe for their captors. Because as people are dragged across the Atlantic to the Caribbean, it provides something of a demographic nightmare for the settler class in the islands. It creates great disproportions in terms of populations and numbers. In certain areas and precincts of the Caribbean, the Africans outnumber the Europeans 20 to 1. And this creates fertile and favorable conditions for uprisings, for revolts, for liquidation plots, for murders, for massacres, for poisonings, and not to mention preceding shipboard insurrections, all of which helps to generate a certain kind of enmity, not least between Africans and Europeans, a kind of enmity that since we've had no Truth and Reconciliation Commission, a la South Africa, after the end of slavery, not to mention the end of, or the erosion of Jim Crow, those kinds of tensions have yet to be grappled with in an honest sort of way and therefore still bubbling and percolating. Because of the tremendous explosion of slave uprisings that take place in the Caribbean, this causes many of the settlers to try to depart the Caribbean, despite the enormous profits that are being made. And what happens is that there is a great trek from the Caribbean to the North American mainland. You may know that before about 1750, London thought that the Caribbean was a more profitable enterprise than the North American mainland, that is to say, the colonies that helped to form the United States of America. With this great trek of European settlers to the mainland, this creates other problems. This is all taking place in the context of competition between and amongst European powers for control of the great wealth that the Americas, particularly the Caribbean, is producing. When the British settlers and the English settlers migrate northward to the North American mainland, they then have to confront and bump up against other European powers, the Spanish in Florida and in Cuba, for example, and the French in Quebec, for example. What happens is that both of these European powers and their contestation and jousting with the British oftentimes begin to ally with the Africans under the Union Jack, under the British flag. You see this particularly in one of the more significant uprisings that takes place on the mainland of North America, which is 1712 in New York City, in Manhattan, where there is an attempt to overthrow slavery, liquidate the settler class, and establish a new polity. The 1712 uprising has French fingerprints all over it. You should also know that Britain has a particular problem in its contestation, particularly with the Spanish. This conflict between these two European powers in some ways takes the cast and the character of a religious conflict, Britain being the leading so-called Protestant power and the Spanish and the French being the leading so-called Catholic powers. Perhaps motivated by religious bigotry, London argues that the Spanish are more prone to place arms in the hands of African troops because so many of the men under the Spanish flag are entering the priesthood because of the strictures of Catholicism. Whatever the case, it's fair to say that the Spanish had begun to arm Africans as early as the 1500s. This puts competitive pressure on the British to do the same in order to contest Spanish hegemony in certain parts of North America, not least Spanish Florida. And as should be, as will be detailed shortly, when London yields to this competitive pressure to arm Africans under the Union Jack, under the British flag, this outrages and enrages the settlers in the 13 colonies that helped to form what is now known as the United States of America, and is one of the points of conflict that leads to the revolt against British rule. You should also know that Britain has a demographic problem in and of itself. Even today, Britain only has a population of about 60 million compared to 300 odd million in the United States of America. And yet, as early as the 1700s, it was either building or had established a massive empire, not least a foothold in the Indian subcontinent. And yet, it was having to confront and contest other European powers with a relatively, not only with a relatively small population, but also Britain felt, or London felt, that under the Union Jack were other nationals, other subjects who were politically unreliable. We all know about the contested relationship between the Irish and the English, which stretches back centuries, which led many in London to feel that the Irish were not necessarily as a class politically reliable. And indeed, as I talk about in this book, there are examples of the Irish collaborating with the Africans in South Carolina against British rule. There were those in London who also felt that the Scots were not necessarily reliable politically. You may know that Scotland only comes into the United Kingdom as of 1707. In the run-up to 1776, there are many revolts against English rule, as they might have it, in Scotland, not least in the 1740s, which is a particularly tumultuous decade. And so as a result of feeling that Britain's population is not that large in the first place, that there are those who are considered to be British subjects who as a class are not politically reliable, and given the competitive pressure from the Spanish in particular in terms of arming Africans, Britain feels that it has little choice but to engage in a similar kind of practice to arm Africans. But as you can readily glimpse, there's something of a contradiction to arming Africans to protect the slave empire, to arm Africans to protect African slavery. Obviously, this introduces tensions and conflicts and contradictions that are difficult to resolve. One possible way out, it was felt, was to establish a so-called all-white colony, which takes place, or is attempted, I should say, in what is now the state of Georgia, north of Florida and south of South Carolina. What's curious today is that Georgia, according to the 2010 census, now has the largest population of African descent in these United States of America. So to fast forward, you can see that that experiment of a so-called all-white colony did not work out very well. But it was as of 1733 that this so-called all-white colony was established in Georgia. It didn't work out very well for many different reasons. One, it was difficult for many poor Europeans to do the hard labor and hard work in the fields. Oftentimes, it was easier for them to escape because their phenotypes were not that dissimilar from the phenotypes of the planters. It was also felt by some that by introducing poor Europeans to be poor laborers, that this was introducing class tensions and class contradictions, which it was thought was the province of Europe, and that these new colonies should seek to escape that. And that leads me to another story that I try to unwind in this book, which not only is a story of the takeoff of capitalism, it's not only a story about the origins of the United States of America, it's also a story about what I call militarized identity politics. That is to say, the construction of whiteness. That is to say, how was it that those who were designated on one side of the Atlantic as English or Welsh or Irish or Scots, as they crossed the Atlantic and settle into this North American mainland, their identity becomes that of white? And I think it's fair to say that the construction of whiteness, and here I'm following in the footsteps of other scholars, although I do think I might add something to this discussion, it's fair to say that this construction of whiteness helps to explain part of the success, quote unquote, of these United States of America. For example, if you look at Spanish colonialism, oftentimes Madrid took the position that in terms of their colonists, they wanted those who profess the Catholic faith. And if you have such a narrow view of colonialism, obviously you're narrowing the base, the population base for colonialism. But if your project is whiteness, basically you're appealing to those whose roots range from the Atlantic to the Urals, a tremendously sizable and large population. And when you do this in the context of calling at least a formal ceasefire in the religious wars between Protestant and Catholic, something that is then incorporated into the vaunted First Amendment of the United States Constitution, now under assault, as we saw with the most recent Supreme Court decision on freedom of religion, when you are saying and suggesting that there's going to be a ceasefire, and I'm choosing my words carefully, in the religious wars, you're expanding the base, the population base for the colonial project. Now, I chose my words carefully because, as I'm sure you know, despite the First Amendment, the United States was a hotbed of anti-Catholicism for the first few decades of its existence, perhaps well into the 20th century, is exemplified by the travails of the first Roman Catholic president, John F. Kennedy, in 1960. And I think we need not discuss the travails, quote unquote, of the first serious Mormon or member of the Church of Latter-day Saints, presidential candidate Mitt Romney, Willard Mitt Romney, in 2012. I'm sure we need not detail the travails of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish fervor, which was also part of the history of the United States of America, as it is to this very day. But it is fair to say that there was a formal truce, a formal ceasefire, which was quite pragmatic in the sense that it did expand the base for the colonial project in North America. So this was part of the problem with constructing the so-called all-white colony in the state of Georgia. Another problem was that across the border in St. Augustine, Florida, which bills itself as the oldest urban center, I should say, on the North American continent, you had a plethora of armed Africans going back decades, and frequently they were crossing the border to attack Georgia and to go further to attack South Carolina, which brings us to the largest and bloodiest uprising of the enslaved in British colonial history, taking place in South Carolina circa 1739-1740. Stono's Revolt, as it has been called, interestingly enough, had the fingerprints of armed Africans from St. Augustine all over it. Stono's Revolt in South Carolina also involved Africans who had roots in Angola, Southwest Africa. Angolans, who oftentimes spoke Portuguese, a language, as you know, is quite similar to Spanish, which facilitated the collaboration between the armed Africans in St. Augustine and these Africans in South Carolina. And also, perhaps not trivial, is the fact that many of these Africans in South Carolina were Catholic and therefore perhaps had some sympathy to His Catholic Majesty in Madrid. And in any case, His Catholic Majesty, in the run-up to Stono's Revolt, circa 1739 and 1740, had sent emissaries across the border suggesting that if these Africans escape to St. Augustine and converted to Catholicism, then they too could be incorporated into the Spanish military and could receive other kinds of benefits. So it turns out that by trying to establish this all-white colony, London had not done itself any favors. It had only complicated its colonial mission. This leads to the conclusion that the only way out for London was to oust the Spanish from Florida and the French from Quebec. That is attempted in the 1740s with mixed results. Particularly important here in the 1740s, as we march towards destiny in 1776, is the fact that the British and the Spanish cross swords in Cartagena, which is part of what we now refer to as Colombia, and much publicity attended the fact that the British forces were shellacked, not least by armed Africans. This shellacking of the British forces in Cartagena also was facilitated by the fact that many of the European settlers on the North American mainland in the so-called 13 colonies were quite reluctant to come to the northern coast of South America to fight the Spanish because they were busily expropriating the indigenous and trying to manacle Africans. This was causing many Londoners to question their patriotism and also to question the nature of slavery, and of course, moving London closer to the fateful moment when it decided to try to abolish slavery in order to deal with all of these tensions and contradictions that I've laid out for you. In the 1750s, finally, London decides to make an all-out push to oust the Spanish and the French from North America. They impose taxes on the settlers in order to fund this effort. This leads to a turning point in the history of North America, if not world history, which is the so-called Seven Years' War, 1756 to 1763, where London is successful in pushing the French out of Quebec. And as you know, you still have a lingering national question of disgruntled French speakers in Quebec as we speak, and pushing the Spanish out of Florida. But in some ways, this too is a catastrophic success for London. Certainly, it's a major defeat for the Africans, because when the Spanish are pushed out of Florida, this removes a rear base from which Spanish Africans could ally with the Spanish to attack their mutual antagonists in Georgia and South Carolina. But also as a result of pushing the Spanish out of Florida and the French out of Quebec, this infuriates Paris and infuriates Madrid, and it allows the French and the Spanish to then cut a deal with the settlers, the British settlers in the 13 colonies, to ally in order to push the British out of North America. This particular decision is also facilitated by another momentous event, which is June 1772, Somerset's case, whereby Lord Mansfield, a Scottish judge, by the way, rules that at least in terms of the Sceptred Isles, this part of Western Europe where London rules, that slavery would no longer persist, that it would be abolished. It does not take an oracle or a seer to divine that that decision could be exported to the North American mainland, which was the fear of many colonists. The Somerset case, this decision to abolish slavery that emerges from London in June 1772, infuriates and enrages and outrages many of the settlers. This is taking place as London is arming more Africans to send them to the North American mainland in order to patrol European settlers. This is obviously inconsistent with the settler model of development, which is based upon the relentless oppression and despotism towards people of African descent. Not only that, but they are complaining about the taxes that had been imposed in order to fund and facilitate the Seven Years' War that pushed the Spanish out of Florida and the French out of Quebec, supposedly guaranteeing and securing their security. Other events that take place that are important to understand in the run-up to 1776 is that the British, during the Seven Years' War, not only pushed the Spanish out of Florida, they temporarily pushed the Spanish out of Cuba, but they make a ruling that the slave trade to Cuba would be regulated, which outrages many of the slave dealers in the Carolinas in particular. They feel that this violates that cardinal principle of free trade in Africans. And then you may know that the settlers had a justifiable reputation of being past masters at smuggling, and this was a way to evade and avoid taxes. And there was one particular case that takes place at the same time the Somerset's case was erupting that is particularly critical in this eventuality. What I'm referring to is there was a ship called the Gaspee and off the coast of Rhode Island that's attacked by settlers led by John Brown, who not the anti-slavery crusader, but the man who gave his name to the Ivy League University, Brown University, a major slave dealer. And he was also a leading smuggler, and his attack on the Royal Navy led to his being captured. And as it turns out, a major witness against him is a man of African descent. And this, too, is infuriating to the settlers, who feel this is one more bit of evidence in terms of this, what they see as a developing alliance between Africans and London against their interests. To move the story further, let me say that another characteristic of this revolt against British rule in 1776 that leads to the formation of the United States of America is what I refer to as the Black Scare. That is to say, the fear that Britain would put more arms in the hands of Africans and that these armed Africans would be used to discipline the settlers. And this fear comes to a kind of fruition in 1775 in the colony that is Virginia, in many ways the most prosperous and lucrative colony, a colony that had a disproportionate number of African slaves, a colony led by men who would go on to play a preeminent role in the formation of the United States of America, such as George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, et al. And as the anti-colonial revolt is brewing in Virginia, the last colonial governor, Lord Dunmore, makes the decision, the fateful decision, to establish so-called Ethiopian regiments, regiments of armed Africans, that are enlisted to fight these settlers. And it takes quite a bit to encourage and entice subjects of the crown to rebel against their homeland. And one of the points that I make in this book is that one of the factors that caused so many previously, formerly patriotic British subjects to revolt against British rule was precisely this Black Scare that I argue leads to the formation of the United States of America. Now, this has particular contemporary resonance and contemporary consequences. I end this book talking about the gubernatorial election in the state of Louisiana in 1991, where the Euro-American majority votes substantially for an avowed Nazi and Klansman, David Duke, for governor. And one of the factors that leads to his not being elected, of course, is a massive turnout by the Black vote. But in many ways, the vote for David Duke, given his platform, his anti-Black platform, was in some ways a replay of the Black Scare.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.